All right, good evening, welcome. Yeah, my name is Tim Guile, in case you don't know me, one of the guiding teachers here at Seattle Insight. So we'll start with a meditation for about 40 minutes and offer a little bit of guidance around it. And we'll take a short break and then have a Dharma talk. A poem called Winter Grace by Patricia Farganol. If you have seen the snow under the lamppost, piled up like a white beaver hat on the picnic table, or somewhere slowly falling into the brook to be swallowed by water, then you have seen beauty and known it for its transience. And you have gone out in the snow, if only for the pleasure of walking barely protected from the galaxies, the flakes settling on your parka, like the dust from just born stars, the cold waking you as if from a long sleeping, then you can understand how, more often than not, truth is found in silence, how the natural world comes to you if you go out to meet it, its icy ditches filled with dead weeds, its vacant birdhouses and dens full of the sleeping. But this is the slow down season, held fast by darkness. And if no one comes to keep you company, then watch over your own solitude. In that stillness, you will learn with your whole body the significance of the cold and the night, which is otherwise always eluding you. Winter Grace by Patricia Farganol. So this is the final talk this month on this kind of overview of transcendent dependent origination and also around dukkha. But I also wanted to just acknowledge, you know, the situation in our country, acknowledge the difficulty around it, and try to tie these together a little bit for us. Because our world is really gripped right now with greed, hatred, and delusion. This is, you know, is in some ways always the case, but it's so much in our face these days, and the way that forces of greed and hatred and delusion are encouraged to run unchecked. And it's really staggering. I find myself staggered by it. I feel my heart broken, and I feel, you know, the terror of that situation. Now, actions which are rooted in greed and hatred and delusion are guaranteed to perpetuate those. You know, they cause more hatred to come back, either from your own expression or the way you relate to it. This includes hatred meeting hatred. You know, and this is the quandary we come from. Because hatred invites more hatred in response. This is this age-old issue as human beings that we still haven't figured out. You know, so how do we meet hatred? How do we meet delusion? How do we meet greed? And how do we confront them? How do we confront acts of hatred? So that, you know, the words of Martin Luther King Day was a week ago, still ring true. And he quotes, to quote him, he says, "I'm concerned about a better world. I'm concerned about justice. I'm concerned about brotherhood and sisterhood. I'm concerned about truth." And when one is concerned about that, they can never advocate violence. Through violence, you may murder a liar, but you can't establish the truth. Through violence, you may murder a hater, but you can't murder hate through violence. Darkness cannot put out darkness. Only light can do that. And I say to you, I have also decided to stick with love, for I know that love is ultimately the only answer to humankind's problems. I'm not talking about an emotional bosh when I talk about love. I'm talking about a strong, demanding love. For I have seen too much hate, and I say to myself that hate is too great a burden to bear. I've decided to love. So this is a, you know, obviously a very difficult time in our country then also. And we seem to be repeating that in its own form these days. And we can translate love as wisdom and compassion. And so the question I think is we have as trying to be engaged people in the world and Dharma practitioners is can actions that have a root of wisdom and compassion still have power in the world? Can they have a chance to actually eradicate greed, hatred, and delusion? You know, can wisdom and compassion have a sense of outrage, a sense of courage with these actions, a sense of power behind those actions? And how does actions flow from that? I think we all know how hatred generates actions, how greed generates actions, how delusion generates actions. But what about wisdom and compassion? What actions flow from that? Can there be a strong no, this is not okay, and yet rooted with clarity, with wisdom and compassion? And I think yes, I think actually that's the only way through is to come from that place of not hatred meeting hatred, but coming from our own wisdom and compassion to bring that forth as much as we can. Now part of the issue is that until we have a complete, lasting, sustained awakening of our hearts and minds, our actions are always going to be a little bit mixed. Sometimes there's going to be a little bit more hatred than kindness, a little bit more greed than generosity. And so it's like, how do we work with that balance? So our task really is to learn to recognize when what's driving this. Is it driving, being driven by my greed, by my hatred, by my ignorance, my delusion? Or is it being driven from a place of compassion or a place of wisdom? And this exploration of transcendent origination starts to point to how to really eradicate those deeper roots of greed and hatred and delusion. But we don't have to wait until we're awakened. We can practice it. It's actually critical that we practice it from wherever we are along the path. How do we bring forth that wisdom, that compassion? How do we start to recognize when we're coming from a place of hatred, of closing our hearts? It doesn't mean we have to be passive. Actually, it requires us to be much more active and engaged in the world, allowing our actions to flow as much from wisdom and compassion as possible. Now, hatred and delusion and greed don't just kind of come out of nowhere. They don't come arbitrarily arise. And the same thing with wisdom, and the same thing with compassion. They don't just kind of come out of nowhere. There's conditions which support that, conditions which allow those to arise, one versus the other. Now, there's a sutta called the Discourse on Supporting Conditions that really speaks to this. And this is, perhaps has already been covered this month, but we'll explore it a little bit more. And this phrase called causal conditionality, sometimes I've heard it said that that's one of the defining features of the Buddha, that he'd sum up his teachings that if there's this, then there's that. If there's not this, then there's not that. Basically the cause and effect, but seeing deeply how that arises. So as I go through this sutta, just kind of brushed lightly going through it, you can see how each condition leads to the other one. Now this sutta is interesting because it actually does a reverse engineering thing on it. It actually starts with fully awakened mind and walks backwards. And it actually goes the transcendental dependent origination, and then also goes through dependent origination. So I think there is said that the human mind can hold easily about 5 or 7 things, and there's about 22 in this list. So don't feel like it's too much, you know, just kind of listen to whatever it resonates. But you can start to see how each piece leads to another. And I think that perhaps gives us some clue about, you know, one, the potential for really eradicating greed, hatred, and delusion, both in our own minds and hearts, but also in the world. And at the same time, it also shows the power of why it keeps perpetuating, why it keeps continuing. So this reverse engineering. So starting with this awakened, fully awakened mind and heart. So it starts with the destruction of the cankers, destruction of the defilements. Okay, so you know, Buddhism is sometimes puts things in the negative, right? I think our Western mind would like, you know, something really, you know, the supreme mind that's connected to all beings without any distinction. But I think the Buddha often talked about what the practice is not. Okay, the reason is it's easier to keep an open mind than if you know what it is. Because I could say it's the supreme interconnection without any sense of separation. Our mind's going to make a story around that. But if we start to say, okay, it's not this, it's not this other thing, then there's a sense of a more alive relationship to it. So the cankers are really we could say, think of them as the deep roots of greed, hatred, and delusion. So the destruction of it means that they just don't arise anymore. They simply do not rise in the awakened mind and heart. Now that doesn't come from nowhere, right? That comes from the factor that supports that is emancipation or freedom. The sense of freedom from those. And so this is, so before they completely fall away, we stop being driven by them. We stop being pulled by them. We can see that they're still here, but they no longer have any power over us. Now what precedes that, the next, the link before that is dispassion, right? Dispassion. So dispassion is really interesting word in our culture because we like to be passionate, we like to be really engaged and excited by things. But think about the passion that comes from hatred, right? The passion that comes from greed and from delusion. And you can look at the news and very shortly, quickly see how much energy there is there. So the dispassion is like we're not being, there's still, these roots are still here, but they're not driving us. They're not really bringing our energy forward in the same way. What supports that to arise is what's called disenchantment. Okay, disenchantment. And this is maybe one of the most critical pieces. And I love this word disenchantment because it points to how we're under real illusion. An illusion, a kind of a spell over our minds that greed is actually a good thing in our hearts. Because we get all these pleasurable things. Hatred is a good thing in our hearts because we can lash out and assert ourselves and punish those and cause revenge. Delusion is a good thing because we can be lost in this unclarity. So the sense of disenchantment is like we wake up to that fact. We actually see things directly for ourselves. And this is a thing, even though this is kind of way down the enlightenment road, we still see in our lives, even as how long you've been practicing, you can probably look at times in your life where things just naturally start to fall away. In my own life, there's different activities or goals I had that at some point they just stop having the same juice for me, the same energy for, because I started them really from a place of trying to become a better person. You know, like there's this, what I mean by that, there's a sense of lack in myself that if I gain this skill or this role or this identity, then I'll finally be happy in myself, right? The disenchantment, you start to see the fallacy of that pattern. You know, you can see it with possessions. You know, if you happen to be a bit of a greedy type, like my mind tends to go that way, it's like if I get this one thing, then finally I'll be happy. But yet we get that possession and then it kind of dulls and then we want the next thing, right? So disenchantment is kind of waking up to this whole process, waking up to the kind of the seeing through the message that our minds say. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy things. We can't have pleasures in life. In fact, in some ways it's much more freed up because we don't have this added on sense of my identity, my sense of well-being is dependent upon that. In fact, it's a more intense pleasure because we realize it is impermanent. It's coming and going. So there's a delight in that, but there's not the holding on. There's not the contraction. So disenchantment, you can start to notice in your own life how that just naturally happens. It's not because you decide not to do something or give it up. It just doesn't pull you in the same way because something is transforming in yourself. You're seeing yourself in a different way, seeing through the sense of self. Now, disenchantment doesn't just happen. It needs a supporting condition. And the one in this transcendent list is the knowledge and visions of things as they really are. Okay? The knowledge and vision of things how they really are. Right? So before we become disenchanted, we actually have to see things clearly. Now, this in itself is a big deal because our vision, the way we perceive, is so colored and shaped by our history, by our conditioning, by our culture. You know, we rarely see things just how they are. I've said this quote so many times, you're probably tired of it, but that Samuel Green poem, that everything we see carries this burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. Right? So everything we see carries a burden of what we know until we let it be itself again. And you start, I think we all can experience this burden ourselves when someone projects on you and says, oh, you're that kind of a person because you're that gender or you're that, you know, that race or that age or that size. They see you through their projections or ideas of whatever they think that is, instead of seeing who you really are and how painful that is. That's so painful to be having prejudice and biases against us, right? And we do that outward too. So seeing things how they are is like clearing up that lens of projection, that lens of bias, of racism, of prejudice, of even preconceptions, to see things how they actually truly are in this moment. Right? Not through our ideas or our concepts, but the direct experience. And in that direct seeing of it, there's a silence, there's a quiet that's there. Any word or idea we put on that creates this level of separation and abstraction. Okay, so seeing things how they actually are. Our meditation practice starts to teach that from day one. What does the breath actually feel like in this moment? Now, what supports this factor, seeing things how they are, this path, is concentration. Concentration. So we spent a whole month on it last year from the lens of the Eightfold Path. For those of you who were on the retreat at Cloud Mountain with me just a few days, I guess it was about a week ago, I went through the seven factors of awakening, and concentration is another one of those things that shows up there. So concentration, you know, there's a wide spectrum of that. But from this context, it's how do we steady our attention enough to start to burn through our layers of delusion, or burn through our layers of confusion, right? So we need to have an attention that's able to be steady and to rest on something, to actually see through kind of the waves of resistance, the waves of turbulence that comes off it. Because that's exactly what happens. If we start to look at something that's painful, that seems to be really charged in us, there's often kind of, it's a little bit going through the atmosphere of the plane. It gets bouncy, right? It kind of feels that resistance. But concentration has this steadfastness to keep seeing, to keep perceiving, to see what's actually here. Right? So it burns through those layers of delusion. And that supports this seeing things how they actually are. So what supports concentration, this is an interesting one, it's happiness, right? It's happiness, right? So concentration, I think if we start instructions saying, okay, I want everyone to concentrate, you know, we'll furrow our brows and strain and sweat, and we'll probably get pretty exhausted pretty quickly. We might have some success, but eventually it's gonna fail because there's too much effort. So happiness points to this natural capacity of concentration to grow in us. A happy mind, a bright mind, naturally likes to be concentrated, likes to pay attention. You know, and it's not the happiness that we think of as like going to Disneyland or, you know, the happiness of having your football team win. That's for you, Tamara. So that's how, that's, okay. That says it all. So there's the joy in that. This is you know, the joy of celebration, of success. But this is a happiness which is outside of conditions. Okay, it's happiness if you win or lose, a happiness of that sense of ease beyond conditions. Now what leads to happiness is tranquility. Okay, that sense of calmness, that sense of settledness, that sense of being, it's that balance of energy. Now, tranquility, what leads to that is rapture. Okay, so rapture is a, where we have to unpack a little bit, because all culture has rapture. There's a kind of a Christian connotation to that. There's this kind of ecstatic energy to it. But it's also, it has some of that qualities, like this energy that's really building. One way to think of it is our systems are often a little bit out of kilter, right? We're a little bit out of alignment. And what happens when rapture happens is when things get lined up, there's an energy flow that is allowed to go through. I use this example on the retreat. Wrath of Khan movies, yeah, I think all of them have that scene where the Enterprise is crippled because the warp drive's out of alignment, and either Kirk or Spock, depending on the movie, goes into the radioactive thing and bravely puts it back together. The ship comes to life and it is saved, but they, of course, sacrifice themselves. But luckily not really, because of a little trick there. But anyway, the point of it is when it gets lined up, that's when there's this big energy thing that goes through. And so when we're practicing, we're often aligning ourselves up. There's, we're lining up our hearts, our minds. There's a physicality of it. And when that gets lined up, there's often a lot of energy that comes up. So it can feel like a very intense experience. It can feel very pleasurable, but sometimes it gets to the point where it's like a little too much energy. That's why tranquility helps to counterbalance that. See that in the seven factors of awakening and also in this list. Now, what leads to rapture is joy, right? So joy is kind of a quieter version of it. It's a joy. This is this peace that we often feel. If you meditate and you feel like there's a steadiness of attention, you go on a retreat, and there's just a quiet sense of joy, of contentment. There's a sense of ease as you move through the world. Just seeing the simplicity of a tree, the sky. It's not jazzy, it's not all exciting, but allows us to really experience that sense of ease and peace. So joy leads to rapture. Now what comes before joy is the first factor, and that is faith. Okay, so faith. Now faith is an interesting one, because we don't often talk about that so much in our normal, it's not part of the Eightfold Path, it's not part of the Four Noble Truths, it's not part of dependent origination, it's not of the five aggregates, but faith is such a critical piece, the faith that things could be different, that there's this potential for my heart to be less contracted, there's a potential for my mind to be freed. And this is the faith that brought the Buddha on his path. This faith that, okay, he saw this major issue that he was subject to old age, sickness, and death. There's a faith that must be something outside of that. And this day and age, we can bring forth the three refuges, faith in the Buddha, in the Dharma, and in the Sangha. You know, looking at all the people who practice, all the people here at Seattle Insight, all the people who are practicing throughout the country, throughout the world. You know, people have a lot of conviction and practice because it's worked for them, and that brings that quality of faith. Now, what's a supporting factor for faith? Right, is suffering. Is dukkha, right? So, this is very interesting because dukkha, suffering, it said, just go into the cosmology for a second. You know, you don't have to believe in this, but traditionally there's different realms of existence. There's the human realm, there's the animal realm, there's the hell realms, the heavenly realms. And if you're in one of the hell realms or animal realms, you're so busy trying to survive. There's so much suffering, you can't get your head above water. If you're one of the heavenly realms, you have too much pleasure. You're like, why practice? Things are pretty good. And the human realm is said to be the right mixture of suffering and ease, right? So there's enough suffering that you're not content, but there's not enough ease that you're not overwhelmed, right? So that's each of our lives. You know, sometimes we have things we born into, maybe a wealthy family and good conditions, loving parents, and things are going pretty well. And then, you know, we lose someone, or we get a health crisis, or something happens in the overall nation, and you know, then there's a suffering arises, right? Or maybe we're born in a very difficult circumstances, but perhaps we meet people along the way who see us and support us and protect us. So it's this balancing of suffering and ease that seems to be the right amount. So suffering as the first condition, from once you're in the midst of suffering, this is what we often come to the Dharma. I certainly came through the Dharma from the lens of dukkha. I'm suffering from having a very painful relationship ending, a relationship ending which was painful, I should say. Because that sounds good the first way I said it. So, but you know, feeling devastated, worrying about, you know, what the future will hold. And there's a lot of suffering, and to realize, oh, there's maybe a way to work with that suffering, to meet that suffering in a way that wouldn't be so overwhelming. That's what brought me into the Dharma. I think many of us can relate to that. Now, suffering, this is a kind of a dividing line between transcendent, dependent origination, or transcendental, dependent origination, and just dependent origination. Because that suffering, we can relate to it in a way that generates more suffering. That kind of goes down this other route, which is what we'll go into now. So the precursor to suffering, the supporting condition, is birth. Okay. So birth, Ajahn Chah was once, I think it was Ajahn Chah, he was giving advice to someone who was so lost in their grief. And he said, this is kind of a strong medicine, but he said, you know, why are you crying for this person who's already died? If you want to spritz, you know, shed tears, cry when they're born. Because if they're born, that's a precursor for dying. You know, it's pretty harsh, but there is some truth to that. It's like, you know, we come into our lives, you know, we were born, we will experience suffering. We will experience dukkha. This context of the dependent origination, so you can see there's transcendent, and then right in this lynch point of suffering, we either go into faith or we go back into ignorance, right? So right here, birth is also the part of this self-identity, the self, the illusion of separate sense of self, right? So this is an interesting thing to think about in our culture, because there's so much emphasis on psychological health and mental well-being and health, that's all very valuable. It's very helpful. It's good to have a healthy sense of self-esteem, a sense of being, having your place in the world, feeling a sense of belonging. So we can't kind of skip over that. And at some point, once that we have that's enough comfort, enough ease in ourselves, at some point you realize that sense of self is not so stable. It's not so lasting. Right? And you sometimes don't realize how invested you are in that sense of self until something strips it away from you. Right? If you are like myself, I went through this as a father when my daughter went off to college. It's like, okay, this is a big step that she's no longer a little girl that needs the father that's always there for her. She needs a father that's able to transition into letting her find her own way in the world. Right, but there's a sense of attachment, there's a sense of gripping. I want to still stay in that role because it serves the sense of me, Right? If those of you who are, you know, have a job, you get fired from, you lose a job, you get laid off, or conditions change. If you're more you're invested in that job and that role, that identity, the more suffering we'll have. Relationships, when they pass, state of health, state of youth. You know, have you ever noticed you're not young as you used to be? Right? If you look, you know, sometimes we have this image of ourselves that's like 20 years out of date, you know, but if we look at our mirrors, it's like, whoa, who is that person with the gray beard and the wrinkles and all that stuff, right? The more attached we are, the more suffering we have. And we can take this on almost in a moment, it is a moment by moment arising, and a moment by moment, the sense of self's arising in relationship conditions and then falling back away. That arising, there's going to be some level of suffering with that. Right? If it's a great, pleasant sense of self, the suffering happens when that ends. If it's a painful sense of self, I'm depressed, I'm angry, I'm fearful, there's suffering in the midst of that. So what leads to that sense of birth? Right? This is what's called, the translation here says existence, but I like the sense of becoming. You know, that sense of becoming. It's like this, you're starting to form into this sense of self. And what leads to, prior to that is clinging and craving. Right? So I'm going to kind of blur those together for a second. I'll just blur feeling with that too. Actually, let's do a whole bunch of them all together. Contact. Contact. So I'm reversing the order for a second. So contact is when we hear something, think something, smell something, see something. That moment of contact through one of our senses, remember thought, cognitive is considered one of the sense gates from Buddhism, that often can trigger our relationship to it, right? So you hear something and let's say it's pleasant. Okay, there's a pleasant quality baked in. Or maybe it's unpleasant. Or maybe it's neither pleasant or unpleasant. That's just kind of natural experience. Nothing, no big deal about that. But the trouble is that usually we start to go into wanting more of it or wanting less of it. And so we start to go out in this slippery slope of start to move toward it and it gets more intense and then we go into this becoming. So what the precursor to this, a supporting factor of contact, is just the senses being active and open, right? If your eyes are closed or you don't have sight, that's not going to trigger it. So, you know, one of these other senses have to be present. The next one is nama rupa, or name and form. Right? This one I find really fascinating because name and form puts back into how we project on the world these ideas of how things should be, the identification around things, our preferences, our liking and disliking. And what we act from that. We see something, we act from it. So name and form is like there's the seeing of it and there's the form that comes together or the actions around it. When I gave a talk on this, when we went through dependent origination back in the pandemic, I used the example of a tree. Right? So if you see a tree out there, like I was trained originally as a forester, so I could look at the tree, I could identify the species, I could identify, you know, how well it's growing, the square foot, if you cut it up into log, you know, to boards, you know, all those kind of things. Someone else might look at that same tree and say, okay, it's really beautiful. I want to have that in my front yard. Or someone might say, I don't like that because it's shading my yard. Or a kid might look and say, it's a nice place for a treehouse. So all these people see the exact same tree, but their name and form is different. What we see it and how we act around it is kind of really embedded that. Now, consciousness is the one that precedes that. So consciousness is the kind of the container that's actually aware of this. We can walk through life with some of our senses kind of shut down. We're just not paying attention. Maybe we're lost in thought. We don't even realize we walked past somebody. We haven't walked past, seen a tree that we walked by because our consciousness is focused on one versus the other. And then what precurses that is kama formations or sankharas. So sankharas, some of these are really powerful ones. So cars is one of those ones which is helpful to pay attention to because it's called volitional actions, volitional input. So basically, as we what we do tends to wear a groove for happening in the future. I remember for a while after I would do like a day long, I would go get myself a little treat, right? So pretty soon that became non-optional. It wasn't a choice. It's like I almost had to do that. I trained myself to do that. The action, volitional choice leads to that, right? So here's a more personal one. Do you guys ever have self-judgment, judgmental thoughts, right? So, okay, if you don't, you can stop listening. But if you do, every time you think those thoughts, you're kind of setting the system to have more of those thoughts, right? And the, otherwise, if you see that thought and choose not to add more energy to it, you're doing more of a positive sankara. You start to create a different groove that starts to develop. And then the final one is ignorance. Okay, the first step of this whole 22 thing is ignorance, delusion. And from that root of delusion, that's when greed comes forth, that's when hatred comes forth, this confusion of not understanding how things actually are. Right? And so this way you can see how from the dependent origination side, ignorance leads to all the way we perceive things, which leads to how we react to it, how the sense self arises, which causes the sense of suffering. From that suffering point, we can choose to kind of go back into ignorance and just keep the loop going. And that's how whole our world is so based on that. That people are staying within their closed loop of logic, of self-identity, of self-belief. And that hatred just keeps on going. Or we can go off to transcendental origination, to this place of faith. Maybe there's a different way of being with this. Maybe there's a different way of meeting this hatred and delusion, this greed in my heart and in the world. And that's what we're going to explore this year, what that is like. So let's just sit quietly for a couple moments, letting those words settle. And we'll give some space for any questions or sharing you might have. All right, thank you for your kind attention. I know that's a lot of concepts, a lot of words, but hopefully you kind of got the sense of the movement, how this one thing is dependent upon this other thing being there. If it's not there, then it falls away, both toward our suffering and also toward our liberation. So if you have any questions or comments.
Hi, why is birth not at the beginning of the list?
Say that one more time.
Why is birth not at the beginning of the list?
Oh, at the beginning of the list. Well, from the dependent origination side or from the transcendental side?
Either. Yeah, both of them, I think that answering both of those could be insightful.
Yeah, so from the dependent origination side, birth is kind of the accumulation of this. It's really transcendental or dependent origination is really this cycle that kind of keeps going through, right? So birth is kind of like the culmination. It's like that sense of identity. And it, you know, it's happening constantly, but there's all these kind of precursors that make that arise. And so that's just the way of framing that. So we see that sense of self arise, but then when that ends and when there's a sense of suffering that arises, do we go back into ignorance or do we go into faith? Maybe there's a way that I don't have to be so, take this so personally. You have to take this so in such a self-identified way. So it's really that sense of suffering that's part of it. That, you know, leads from birth to dukkha, to suffering.
Is that the transcendental side?
That's the transcendental side, yes.
And the dependent origination side? Are you implying that was different?
Well, I wasn't trying to imply it different. It's more like that choice point. So let's say in this side, there's all the, the dependent origination side, the cycle going back and forth, back and forth. There's, you know, ending with birth, then going into suffering, which which goes into ignorance, kind of reinforces that. From that place of birth, then you can jump off into faith, which is going to the transcendental side of things, which moves into toward awakening.
Thank you. And could you define birth for me just one more time?
Sure. So birth is kind of inhabiting this sense of self, this kind of momentary sense of self. So it's when you feel, okay, like I'm really kind of invested in it. I really identify with it. It's like, how would I describe myself in this moment? Right? So let's say that, you know, to make it simpler, let's say I read the news and I'm really angry about something I'm reading. Okay, there's a sense of me that's become angry, and that's the way that's kind of manifesting. Maybe there's another sense of self that arises a few minutes later that's sad. You know? Or maybe there's a happy sense of self. But the point is that since those senses of self are kind of rising and passing away, and there's kind of this illusion that they're continuous and constant. Right? And this is kind of probably the biggest hurdle as practitioners is to see through that sense of self, to see that it's actually just something that's arising and passing away. That doesn't mean we kind of vanish, but there's a quality of awareness, a quality of knowing, which is much bigger than that sense of self. It's also not something the sense of self can contain or say yes to or say that's mine. Right? So that birthing is really just defining that moment of this is who and what I am.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And it's kind of a slippery area. All right, so yeah, go ahead, Leslie, and then we'll go to Judith online.
So this year we're studying the links. Are the links in hierarchy, or are they just like, you know, I don't understand what the links are, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, in the transcendental origination. The links are basically it's a progression. So one leads to the next, right? And the end point is awakening, and then there's no more links after that.
So we can do it in 12 months?
Yeah, if you're really a good student, you know, at the end of these 12 months, you'll be fully awakened, no more cycling through it. if you want to keep going, dependent origination, just keep cycling, 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 cycling. Transcendent is like, basically ends with full awakening is what it's pointing toward. So we're going to, you know, practice how do we articulate, how do we translate that into our lives in a practical, meaningful way. You're welcome. All right, go ahead, Judith.
Okay, so what conditions have to be present for us to be able to move into faith instead of just keeping going around the circle?
Yeah, that's a great question. And next month we'll talk about that.
I want to know now because I have to talk about it next
month. I'll mention it now, but next month we'll be focusing just on faith. We're just off the top of my head. I think there actually are some particular suttas that talk about that. You know, one is, Rodney used to talk about this a lot, that we just kind of exhaust all other possibilities. We've just tried all the different strategies and they just don't work. You know, we've tried getting lots of toys. We've tried getting lots of different relationships. We've tried different roles, but yet we still have this issue that there's still the suffering here. There's still this angst or this sense of pain that comes from this self-identification. So it's kind of like we've kind of run out of options. And we finally go, it's similar to the Four Noble Truths. It starts with dukkha. And from the place of dukkha, we understand the cause of it, but then there has to be something that moves into, you know, what's a possibility. So that's one piece. There can be the heavenly messenger. You know, remember the fourth heavenly messenger was a monastic, was someone who was practicing and inspired us. So that can be part of it. Maybe you have a friend who's been practicing for a while, or you hear a teacher that inspires you. Sometimes hearing the Dharma can inspire you. You know, and sometimes nature. Sometimes we have these kind of spontaneous spiritual experiences that we realize, well, there's something much more than my normal way of seeing the world. And that becomes this entry point into practicing.
And yet some people just don't do it, right? I mean,
yeah.
And you think that the Buddha thought of this as taking many lifetimes? Or,
well, you know, again, from a cosmology perspective, yeah, there's many lifetimes we go through, and even the Buddha himself, it said that he went through a lot of lifetimes before he came to the lifetime he became awakened. You know, when he first became awakened, he actually didn't really want to teach. He said, you know, people are not going to get this. This is too subtle. They have too much confusion, too much dust in their eyes. I'm going to be just discouraged trying to point the way. But this spirit came and said, no, please, please, please teach, that some people will be able to hear. And so there's a ripeness. And the ripeness is interesting that I don't know what brings that ripeness. Sometimes it's the depth of suffering in our lives. Sometimes that makes us more ripe. Who knows, maybe past lives have influenced that. Maybe it's just what we're exposed to. But there's a certain ripeness that often, you know, brings us into the practice.
So it's if you're ready.
Yeah, if you're ready. I think one sutta talked about it as waterlogged logs, you know, logs which are just soaked in water. And eventually they're going to dry out. But for many of them, you know, some of them are more ready to catch on fire.
It's a mystery. Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, anyone else have anything there? Yes, go ahead.
So thanks for clarifying the birth point, because I had the same question. And then that led to what you just said about like all the lifetimes and all. So when they talk about like many, many lifetimes, is that literally like physical lifetimes, or is it just one life and all those births? And like you said, those moments that are starting like from one moment to the next, and you have like sadness and your anger, and then every one of those are like small life in themselves, and then you are a different person almost at each moment. And those are like all the lifetimes of the Buddha or whoever. But or are we talking about reincarnations or like a new physical body and it's something next?
I think we can hold it both ways. I think it's when we start talking about reincarnation and past lives, it goes from this place of what I can see directly, what I can experience right in front of me, to this, it becomes a little bit more abstract. It's a little bit more of this kind of placing my faith on it or you know, trusting that this is the situation. I think it has a lot of use just from this own life. Like, think about the different bigger forms of self that you've had, like when you were a kid, and then when you a student, and when you got your first job and next job and different relationships, being a father, all those different things are different life, you know, kind of lives that are formed around that, if that makes sense. But we can also look at suttas, and they talk about the past lives. I mean, that more of a literal perspective. So, you know, I kind of take it like, well, probably. But I try to see there's a lot of validity and help just to see it in this life, you know, from this life's perspective. If you're really drawn to that, yeah, that's a fine way to think about it. One thing to think, if you go into that, there's no guarantee the next lifetime will be a good lifetime, right? That's part of the workings of karma, is that, you know, if we have a lot of unethicalness, in the next lifetime, we may be born in a really not so good place, right? So that's part of it. Now, before you get all freaked out about that, the Buddha did caution that karma is one of those things that you just can't understand. You know, as from an awakened perspective, you can see it, but otherwise it's going to tend to drive you crazy trying to think about it. And the workings of it is much harder to say. It's not like a one-to-one ratio. It's not like instant karma. It's more of this tendency. And we can see that in our lives, just how we can train ourselves from a neural perspective. You bet. Yes, in the back. Yeah, comments, fine. Let's give you the mic so they can hear you online.
I guess in terms of like the news, I tend to get really scared and feel a lot of hate.
Yes.
And we were talking about like how do you find like joy, and I feel like when I understand the roots of the systems of oppression, then that helps me to forgive, and that is kind of how I find my joy and my hope. And then in terms of lifetimes, I low-key feel like we're all the same soul having a different life experience, so I feel like the more enlightened you are, the more you can access all the lifetimes, but that's just my opinion.
Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I like that sense of understanding, you know, the roots of the conditions and how that does bring a sense of, okay, I can understand, you know, my heart softens around it. And there's a famous poem by Thich Nhat Hanh that talks about, you know, basically we have been all things for all for each other. You know, we've been, you know, parents and children and lovers and, you know, killers and all these things. There's all these different roles that we've done everything. And yeah, it's like as our minds open up, yeah, there's access to what we see more clearly. So thanks for sharing that. All right, so go ahead, Lauren.
Yes, thank you, Tim. Can you hear me?
Yep, you sound clear.
Okay, great. So I've always had trouble understanding sankharas. And from what you have described here, the base of everything is ignorance. And so we're operating just from greed, hatred, and delusion, just thinking that just responding in that way, like we don't like it, we like it, or we're just so unsure and confused. And then that, the next one that I don't understand. So that takes us to the sankharas, or the sankharas takes us to the ignorance?
Well, it's, so just to clarify, we're talking about dependent origination,
yes,
you know, in that cycle.
Yes.
So yeah, ignorance is that not seeing, that unclarity, that the delusion, you know, seeing that, okay, greed's going to give me lasting happiness, hatred's going to give me lasting, you know, happiness and relief. So that sets up, you know, the logic, basically, the premise. And from that premise, that's how I act in the world, that choice, right? Let's say I have a choice of sending a really mean, angry email, or I have a choice of maybe just sitting with it, right? So that's a choice that I make. So sankharas, that volitional impulse is there's this little choice that we're making. Now, sometimes the choice we may not be realizing we're making, it can happen so quickly, but there's still that bit of an impulse that happens. So it's like when our intention gets behind it. Now, the more we kind of rehearse it, that's why you can see that like in premeditated murder, it's a much bigger crime because you've been thinking about that for a long time. You've been really planning. So that's a bigger consequence for that.
Well, I'm thinking of, you know, when we're physically born and, you know, a little infant just knows what it wants. You know, I mean, it like wants to eat, and it, if it doesn't get what it wants to eat, then it's, you know, it's cries, you know, it hates it. It's,
yeah.
And then it doesn't really understand. It doesn't reflect. And so then from that ignorance, there is, you know, there, it starts. Is it habit? Is that where habit is born? Because you were saying it's like the grooves. You know, it's not reflective. It's just a response based on pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral, basically. Is that right? Or how does it develop into hatred? That's what I want to know.
Well, so let's go back to the baby for a second. So babies, when they're born, you know, they basically are often very undefined. Like they have a sense of, you know, the sense of separation of self and other, self and mother. It's all kind of blurred together, right? At some point, the sense of self kind of pops into that. They become kind of self-conscious. So that's when the volitional stuff start to be activated. That sense of self is there.
Awesome. So, but the self in this picture of dependent origination doesn't really come until birth. You know, the birth of the ego or the birth of the self. I'm just curious how that.
You kind of like, what's the original starting of the cycle?
Yeah.
Yeah, probably the original starting, so this it's kind of considered like an endless cycle, right? It's kind of just keeps going and going. So let's go back to a little child, you know, there's no separation between me and my parents. I'm just connected to everything, putting everything in my mouth, testing, tasting everything. Okay, I'm hungry, I'm crying, I'm tired. And the sense of self pops in maybe around 2 or 3. There's a sense of, okay, I'm different than. Okay, from that point, that's when the sankharas start to come in. So yeah, maybe birth would be that first. Did he already leave? Yeah. That birth might be the first piece that kind of comes in and starts to activate all that. Okay. So depending on how you're taught, you know, if you're taught kindness, you know, that's probably going to be how you're going to tend to be. If you're taught, you know, hatred, or if you're, that's, because hatred and anger, you know, where's that line? Because where's that sense of anger, like I'm scared of something, I'm trying to protect myself, that fight and flight side. You know, from an animal perspective, I don't know how much hatred they have. They might kill something because they want to eat it, or they're scared of it, but they're not dwelling in the hatred. So yeah. Hatred is like when we start to really dwell in that, like I just can't, you know, I hate this person, I keep, can't stop reading about them, and I just, you know, that tightness that keeps going and going.
Yeah, it seems like it has to come in with the ego, you know, when the self is starting to develop. That's when the hatred and the greed and the delusion, it just seems like they're ego-like. They have a quality of that. So anyway, well, I do understand a little bit better, and the choice is a big part of that, because I couldn't figure out what the volitional piece was.
Yep, it's a choice.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
Yes. Ego, just a quick thing about that. So ego is, we could get in all the definitions. I think ego is a nice shorthand for the sense of self, but there's also the whole, you know, kind of Freudian side of the ego too. We can maybe not talk about tonight. All right. Any other questions or comments? Yes. Do you mind if the mic, just so they can hear you online?
Yeah. Thanks, Tim, for the awesome Dharma talk. I think my question is a little bit more about, like, I guess, real-world application of some of the concepts you described, like kind of really not, I guess, reacting or not really, or try to really, I really like the idea you talked about really trying to see things just as they are instead of, like, with all these preconditions and
That's
all
right.
these things. So I was thinking, like, what's a good way to think about it? Because I was thinking what maybe a good way for me to think about it is because I do notice in every, like, stage of my life, I have different priorities, I have different desires, and, right. like, I have different identities. And there's a certain point where I think at every stage, I always have, like, this certain identity that just gets stripped, right? And that causes me to, like, a really big reaction. So mm-hmm. I don't know if a good way of thinking about this is, like, oh, there's going to be a future part of me that's not really going to, you know, maybe value this part of my identity, because we're always changing into different, I guess, versions of ourselves, if that's without a better way to say it.
Yeah, so it's sometimes the different versions of self, maybe don't worry so much about that right now, but just kind of think of it as like holding that sense of me a little bit lighter, mm-hmm. a little bit more, not as solid, right? So when you find yourself really getting engaged, okay, I'm really happy about this, I'm excited about this, I'm mad about this, I'm fearful of this. If you can just step back and say, okay, maybe that's a sense of perspective. That's one way to look at it. It's like, how do I see the world? That's part of that sense of self, sees the world through my particular lens, right? If you ever notice that if you're depressed, you tend to notice everything is depressing around you. You know, if you're angry, you notice everything's irritating. If you're happy, the simple things are joyful. I mean, it's like if I go shopping at Costco, depending on my mood, sometimes it's a great experience. Sometimes it's a bad experience because like, I'm irritated by all these people. Other times, like, oh, yeah, it's okay. You can go ahead of me. And, you know, but that's, it's kind of, there's a flow, a way that sense of self interacts, right? So if you find one that there was kind of patterns that you tend to fall into, just see if you can step back and say, okay, let me just sit in the midst of this. Let me, if I can observe that in itself? What's the sensations of the body? What's kind of the mind state? What's kind of the attitude? What's the emotions? What that's doing is allowing you to step back and observe that sense of you that's in there. So this is a good gateway, right? So this is kind of going into that witness perspective as a meditator. This is just the beginning of it, because eventually you can see through that where that witness actually is, and you realize it's just another part of awareness that's been kind of identified with. But this is a very helpful way of practicing with it.
Yeah, I think it's really good to, I guess, see how you feel, I guess, maybe with something. But how do you, I guess, see that thing itself? Because I feel like what I can sense is kind of my, I guess, reaction to it, which is still me, but it's not like the thing. So I'm just kind of wondering, how do I just get that thing without my reaction? Because that's a little bit, I don't know.
So like the external thing, how do I see that?
Yeah, like just seeing like Costco as Costco, not as like a giant place with full of cars and like I can't even drive in here without like 10 pedestrians crossing, you know, that sort of feeling.
So this is subtle work. And so what I would suggest is make it as simple as you can. And, you know, find a time where you have some space, some time, not a lot of distractions. And maybe pick something like I like nature, because nature is kind of has an alive quality to it. Could be a house plant, you know, or a tree. And just sit with it and see, look at the tree and notice what your mind says about it. I like it. I don't like it. You know, is it, it's really green or it's really brown. You know, it's this kind of a tree. But then notice how that's pointing toward the actually something that you're adding labels to it. Like if you were an alien from another planet, you wouldn't know what a tree was. You'd be relating to a different way. Or if you're a young baby, you'd be like just seeing it, experiencing it. And so you're kind of peeling back the ideas around it. Ideas are going to still come, but you look underneath that to see what's the direct experience. And you look under that deeper and deeper until at some point there's kind of a wordless quality relationship to it. So that starts to teach you that in a more controlled, low stakes manner. And you can start to play with that with other people, other situations.
I see. So kind of trying out with like some simple like things like trees or maybe just some household items, and then kind of working my way up into like just, you know, not reacting to what people say and stuff like that.
Yes. Yeah. There's the not reaction. And then this goes to a point where something shifts in the way you are perceiving it. And when you first do it, it's a little bit disconcerting because you're so used to having your idea established, your opinions about it establish you. If you stop having opinions, the sense of you gets a little bit more diffuse. So maybe like, well, I'm really connected, but I don't know if I like that because my ego wants to know who and what I am.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Tim.
You bet. Thank you for that question. All right, let me go back online, and then we'll go with you next. Okay, go ahead, Debbie.
Hi, Tim. So I feel like I have a good handle on at least sensing into like how to approach delusion and anger. Like that just, I don't know, that just feels more accessible. How do you approach hatred? Like, you know, like what do you do with that feeling?
Yeah, so this is a really important question, especially this day and age. So first of all, I would say approach it without this idea that there's something wrong with it, right? There's more of a sense of what does this experience of hatred actually feel like, right? But to do this, you have to in some ways kind of separate it or kind of suspend the object of the hatred, right? So this actually works with a lot of patterns. The more we focus on the object of hatred, that just fuels it, right? Like, let's say there's a particular individual that you find a lot of hatred for, and you maybe find them, a lot of people talking about them, lots of images of them, and you can focus on that, and you just, you know, get more and more caught in that. But if you can say, okay, let me stop looking at that image for a second. Let me feel what's the actual, almost generic quality of hatred feel like. Right. Now, if you do that, you can start to see your heart is actually in distress. There's a sense of pain and separation that's happening because you're separating yourself from life. Right. And also it's helpful with hatred to realize there's a difference between being really clear and saying, no, this is this activity, this behavior, these actions are not okay. There's a strong no to that. It's not about letting, you know, saying it's okay, but it's that clarity. It's that strength of that power of clarity, right? But hatred is like when I start to really chew on it, and it starts to really chew on us.
So I just to rephrase to make sure I understand it. So you're kind of saying like hatred is the mulling on like the hurt from the actions, or like the sense from like what the actions feel like, and that's separate like from just being with and acknowledging like what this person is doing is not okay. Like those are two separate things.
Say the first one again. You said around the actions of it.
Yeah, it's like you can separate, like you can have a clear no, these actions are not okay.
Yes.
And it is hate. Hate is like the dwelling on the, I don't know, on the feeling or the object of, or the person perpetrating the actions that you'd like.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Kind of, yeah. It's I think one piece also is the territory is where's anger? Can anger be something which is embodied, that's clear? And when does that change into hatred?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So for me, hatred often has something about, I want to destroy this person or this thing.
Yeah.
I want to just eradicate them.
Yeah.
But anger could be like, I'm just really angry at this situation, this actions, this person, you know, but there's the hatred is kind of going that next step.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome. It's a really good inquiry. Yeah, how can we have power and strength saying no, feeling anger, our rage, but when does that go into hatred?
Thanks. One quick question. I was thinking about ignorance in this chain, and my mind went to the Heart Sutra, and I was thinking about this confusion of between form and shunyata. Is that kind of what's, maybe this is more of a technical question, but is that for me sort of feels like what the base case would be of where these things all sort of start going off the rails, is this confusion of these two, form and emptiness. Is that right at what's being hooked into here?
You know, my first impression, I have to think about that a little bit more and feel into it. My first impression, it's a little bit different. When you see that sutta where it talks about form is emptiness and emptiness is form, that's the part you're talking about. That's pointing to this kind of this non-dualistic way of seeing the world. You see that form and empty, because we often kind of have this bias. We're biased toward form, we're biased toward emptiness, but it's trying to bring us back to see. And this is more of this maturation of our practice. That's my sense of where that line is pointing to. I think in terms of like spiritual bypassing, that's when they can get confusing, right? I don't know how much spiritual bypassing is being done in the bigger world. You know, it's more like if a teacher said, you know, my actions, you may think they're not ethical, but it's actually empty, so it's okay. You know, I'm making some, yeah, it's crazy wisdom. It's okay, just deal with it. You know, that's where that can get distorted. Yeah, so I think there's some good things to think about, but my initial thing is it's not quite that. Yeah, thank you for that. All right, so Beth, let's do the last question. Oh, look at that.
Oh,
service.
She's right there. That's why I like her, right next to me. I was, I'm going back to hatred. the dialogue you were having online with the online person. And I was imagining what Philip Moffitt talks about, like, well, he talks about it in terms of greed and grasping, in terms of taking birth. So it's one thing to notice that you like or dislike something or something's appealing. And then there's like a road toward grasping and maybe a road toward hardening of the heart, toward hatred,
uh-huh.
that there, and I've noticed it more in the greed because I am a greedy type and I have plenty of material, but there's this place where it goes from just noticing or observing or liking something to, okay, yeah, I'm going there. And there's that taking birth moment.
That's right.
So would there be similar in the aversion?
Absolutely.
On the aversion path? So there would be that sort of noticing, yeah, that's not right. And then, but then comes the, it is a selfing. The selfing happens, that taking birth of that righteous indignation or premeditation towards something that feels harder. There's a point of no return there that isn't when you just notice that, oh, like, that's not okay.
Yes. Yeah, I think, yeah, exactly. It's just, you can
it
go
It feels
toward,
harder.
Yeah, it's there's a hardening of it. There's this, yeah, there's this momentum. I wouldn't say it's that there's a point of no return. I think there's kind of a point of kind of re-upping it.
Yeah, okay.
You know, versus you're going to, as soon as you recognize it, wisdom can allow the whole thing to collapse.
Okay.
Or, you know, ignorance can just keep on going.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you all for your great questions and engagement around this. And next week, we'll move from the overview into faith, the first of these, right? And how faith is this critical piece. So I'll be starting off the month on the second, and then we have Tweri will be teaching online. We'll still have a physical gathering, but also she'll be online. Then Nana's coming the third week, and then Carrie Peterson will be closing us out on faith. All right, so look forward to this exploration this year with all of you. Thank you, those in person. Thanks online, and may you be well.